March was a busy month in Florida politics. On today's Reporters Roundtable, what you need to know about what will change in the Sunshine State and what won't. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. To walk us through the major highlights of the 2018 Florida legislative session, we have with us Steve Bosquet, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Tampa Bay Times. He's with us from the studios of WFSU in Tallahassee. And Zach Anderson, the political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune, speaking to us from his office in Sarasota. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Steve, I saw a quote from a state senator saying the session was transformed by the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, that the session became before Parkland and after Parkland. What did she mean by that?
Well, I've covered the legislature for 30 years. I've never seen the Florida legislature react so quickly. But of course, we've never seen a crisis and such a horrifying display of violence that we saw at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th. We've had mass shootings before. We've had much more fatalities in mass shootings before, like the Pulse nightclub. The difference, however, is that what happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas happened on school grounds in the middle of a legislative session in an election year. So the Florida legislature and the governor were forced to act and act decisively. Now, a lot of people are unhappy with the result, obviously, but the legislature was forced into action as they never have been before.
So the whole atmosphere up there must have been absolutely changed.
It was. You know, the demonstration of all the people who showed up, 5,000 or 6,000 people who showed up, we've seen bigger demonstrations. But there was a feeling, and we saw it again over the weekend with all the marches around the country, there is this sense that we're living in a transformational moment, that perhaps something, a larger force is taking shape out there in terms of the mass mobilization of so many young people. We'll know on August, I think it's August 28th, is the date of the first primary election. The proof is going to be in a decisive change at the ballot box in this state with elections for the Florida legislature. We'll just have to wait and see.
So, Zach, the legislature did take action on guns. Could you briefly explain what they did?
Sure. It was a pretty unusual bill and a very significant one in a lot of ways. You know, this was the first time since the Republicans took control of state government that they've really passed any kind of gun control measures of any significance. They didn't go as far as a lot of the activists would have liked, but they were still significant measures. One of them would increase the age to purchase long guns like the semi-automatic rifle that was used in the Parkland shooting from 18 to 21. The bill also institutes a 3-day waiting period on purchasing such guns, and it bans bump stocks, which are used to turn semi-automatic weapons into fully automatic weapons. So those are three significant gun control measures. The raising the age limit would have, you know, the shooter in the Parkland shooting was 19 years old. So if you raise the age to 21, that right there potentially could have stopped this and limited his ability to get a weapon like that. On the other side, there was an effort to sort of, I think they felt like they had to appeal somewhat to conservatives who might be wary of these gun control measures. And there was a proposal that is supported by a good number of conservatives that would allow school districts on a voluntary basis to arm school personnel if they go through training. That proposal got some bipartisan pushback. The governor said that he didn't like it. But in the end, these two things were paired together along with additional money for school safety and for mental health screenings and things like that. And they were able to pass a bill that had bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition.
And I saw that it was criticized by the Agriculture Commissioner, Adam Putnam.
Yes, there's a number of conservatives who didn't vote for the bill because of the gun control measures. And I think Putnam was criticizing the bill because of that. You know, and at the same time, the bill's getting pushback from Democrats who don't like the idea of arming school personnel. So there's been criticism from many different directions on this. But it was a bipartisan bill. It was pushed by Republican leadership in the House, the Senate, and the governor. And a number of Democrats voted for it as well. It's also worth noting that all 17 families of the Parkland shooting victims, all of their families signed a letter in support of this legislation saying they felt like this was a good compromise or a good first start.
What was your impression, Steve, of the bill and the feeling, just sort of the atmosphere and the feeling, a feeling of victory that they had gotten this through? Was there a lot of anger on the right?
Yes, there is anger on the right. There's also litigation from the NRA. The NRA has gone into federal court and challenge the constitutionality of the new age restriction. It's going to be interesting to see because the case has been assigned to a Barack Obama appointee who has a track record of issuing decisions against the Rick Scott's administration. It is true that, you know, the NRA is still a force to be reckoned with in the state politically, though I have to say that they took a beating here on this legislation because this is not what Marion Hammer and the NRA wanted. Representative Joe Gruters, who's from Sarasota, said to me that any Republican who was seeking higher office, who voted for this bill, is in serious political trouble. Now, Gruters himself voted for the bill and is running for the state Senate in Sarasota. But there were 19 Republicans in the House who voted against this bill, and most of them are seeking higher office. This is the first time since the Republicans took full control of the legislature that we've seen them take on the gun lobby like this. Rick Scott had both the tenacity and I think he had the good political sense to work this bill through with the parents of the Parkland victims and with the survivors. And so this bill had, broad-based support. Having said that, it barely passed the Florida Senate. Had one senator voted against the bill who voted for it, it would have died on a tie vote. So it was by no means a sure thing. I think we're also going to see from now through November, we're going to see the Democratic Party and people who want stricter gun control continue to play the narrative of the legislature wouldn't ban assault weapons, the legislature wouldn't support universal background checks. I'm hearing anecdotal reports all over this state that Republicans are polling and finding a surprisingly high level of support for additional gun control measures.
I think the politics of this are interesting because they also really show the power of the primaries, because Rick Scott is not going to have to run in a primary when he runs for the Senate. Adam Putnam is going to have to face challengers from the right in his primary. And so I think that has something to do with where they came out on this gun bill.
In the absence of a true, vibrant two-party system in Florida, which is what we have at the legislative level, what you have are basically two Republican parties. And that's why the most competitive and the most contentious elections you often see are Republicans against each other in a primary.
Zach?
You don't see really any Republicans who are running for statewide office supporting this bill, whether it's attorney general candidates or candidates for governor. And it appears to be the same thing on the Democratic side. They don't really seem to be in favor of this bill too much either. And so it's fascinating how you see folks, like you said, the governor doesn't have to face a primary. So, you know, he's a little bit insulated from this. But the folks who do face primaries, there's a lot of concern that the people who are really driving the debate on this are sort of the base of the party, you might even say sort of a bit to the extreme on some of these issues, and they're worried about getting crossed with those folks in a purity test in the primaries.
Those that are energized are usually voting in the primaries, I guess. The legislature also appropriated an $88.7 billion budget. Steve, how does that budget compare to past years?
Well, it's the biggest budget we've ever had by a category of at least $2 billion. Now, that's somewhat a little bit of hyperbole in there because in a state that is as dynamic and fast-growing as Florida is, every budget is bigger than the one that preceded it. I think there may have been one or two exceptions to that rule during the Great Recession of a decade ago, but generally speaking, the budget is bigger every year. This budget is noteworthy for a couple of reasons. The legislature and Governor Scott agreed to put more money into higher education. The outgoing Senate President Joe Negron is a firm believer in trying to make the university system better than it is, and that takes money. So that's one area. there's been a lot of criticism of the increase in K-12 funding. And as you saw recently, school superintendents called on the governor to call a special session to shore up K-12 funding. He refused. The reason for that is, though there's more money for school districts, it's largely earmarked for specific programs, much of it a direct result, again, of the Parkland shooting. The hiring of school resource officers and additional mental health money and security measures at public schools.
Okay, so Steve, let me stop you there because this is a little confusing. So the budget allocates increases spending more than $100 per student in K-12. And I read that it also allocates $400 million for school safety. So is there a conflict there or are they not? Is that $100 per student an increase? Is that part of the $400 million?
Yes, it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And
okay.
However, it comes with strings attached. The Florida legislature tells school boards how to spend that money. Every school district is a little bit different, and there's a problem with this categorical aspect of school funding that frustrates local educators because the legislature tells them how to spend the money.
Okay.
And that's what's happening.
Okay, so here's your increase, here's your money, we've increased your spending, but we're telling you, you must spend X amount on school safety, even if you need it for your math programs.
That's correct.
Okay. Zach, any surprises in this budget for you?
You know, what really stands out about this budget is that nobody's ox really is getting gored here. There's no major cuts to programs. There was some talk about shifting hospital funding payments at one point, and that in part was one of the reasons why the legislature went into overtime to pass a budget, and that would have hurt some of the safety net hospitals, but they decided against doing that. And so the budget is really an election year budget. You know, they increase funding in all areas. You know, there's not a lot of people who have reason to gripe necessarily about this budget. Although, as we see, there was some complaints from the school officials that the increase was a bit of an illusion.
Right. Also in the budget for the environment, it includes $100 million for Florida Forever, which is the state's environmental land buying program. There's $175 million for Everglades restoration, $50 million to expedite the rehabilitation of the Herbert Hoover Dike at Lake Okeechobee. I think that was part of the problem they were having with the water quality down there. But you're hearing from environmentalists that it hasn't been a successful budget for them. We have Tom Palmer, who's that great environmental reporter at the Ledger, saying that legislators weren't good to environmentalists. Why not?
I think one thing that environmentalists are saying is that we're happy that there's more funding than there was, but we still don't think it's enough. You know, the Florida Forever funding, for example, over $100 million, that's a program that used to get around $300 million under Jeb Bush and other governors. Now, it's a lot bigger than it was last year when it had no money whatsoever. So I think environmental groups are happy that they went from zero to $100 million. That's a substantial increase, but I guess they don't want, you know, the impression to be that now everything is okay. You know, they still believe that there should be more funding for these environmental programs, especially since the 2014 constitutional amendment, Amendment 1, that mandated that the legislature set aside a third of the money from these dock stamp real estate transactions towards conservation. And a lot of people, even a significant number of Republicans, have said that the legislature didn't really follow through with that amendment, that they shifted money around and didn't really use that to increase environmental funding. So I think there's a sense that while this budget is, you know, from an environmental perspective, is better, it's not what they would really like to be seeing going forward.
I think the estimate was $700 million they thought would be coming for environmental programs from those dock stamps. So to have nothing last year was, they're being sued, right?
Yeah, the Sierra Club and some other environmental groups are suing the legislature, saying that they have ignored the will of the voters when it comes to Amendment 1. And it's worth noting that they're not dropping that lawsuit because they put $100 million towards Florida Forever this year. One of the reasons they're continuing with that lawsuit is that they believe that the legislature still has not complied with that constitutional amendment despite the increase in funding this year.
I'm Robin Sessingham, and you're listening to Florida Matters. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sessingham, and it's the monthly Reporters Roundtable. From the studio of WFSU in Tallahassee, Steve Bosquet is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Tampa Bay Times. And from his office in Sarasota, Zach Anderson is the political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Opioids was going to be one of the major legislative pushes this year, and it kind of got pushed to the back burner after Parkland and everything happened with gun control, but they did pass a law that limited opioid prescriptions. Steve, can you describe some of what was in that bill?
Yes. Well, it's mostly money to limit prescriptions and to provide additional treatment. And there's also money for the drug that tries to get people off opioid addiction. It has become a severe problem in parts of the state. Doesn't appear to be going away. You're right. The opioid issue was front and center, at the tail end of 2017. Rick Scott made the funding issue a priority. But then, of course, came Parkland and everything changed. But I think we're seeing now, interestingly, we saw a few days ago, Adam Putnam, Republican candidate for governor, call for the return of a so-called drug czar. Rick Scott abolished a specific Office of Drug Control policy after he became governor. And, of course, the opioid epidemic has been with us now the entire time Scott's been governor. I found a press release the other day from Bill McCollum. Bill McCollum was the Republican candidate for governor in 2010 and was attorney general at the time, and he was dealing with a major epidemic of drug use and drug abuse a decade ago in this state. This problem is not new, and it's not going away.
Zach, do you have anything you wanted to add about the opioid legislation?
Well, as Steve said, a lot of the bill was focused on funding for treatment, which is a significant step, trying to make sure that, you're treating people before their addiction spirals out of control. The bill also set some pretty strict limits on pain pill prescriptions. Pain pills were a big problem in the state when the governor, Rick Scott, first took office, and then they tried to crack down on some of the pill mills and go after unscrupulous prescribers, and that had an effect to some degree, but it also sort of drove people towards street drugs like heroin and fentanyl. So they set new limits where for acute pain, which is pain from a surgery or an accident or something like that, you can only get a 3-day supply of these pills unless you get a special note from your doctor that says it's medically necessary, and then you can get a 7-day supply. And studies show that the longer you're on these pain pills, the more likely you are to get addicted. So that's why they want to put a cap on it, because in the past, people were getting like 30-day supply. They were on these pills longer than they needed to be, and they started to get addicted to them. And that has just fed into a horrible epidemic in this state. So, they took this step. This is not something that's unique to Florida. Other states around the country have been looking to limit pain pill prescriptions. And even CVS, the big pharmacy chain, actually instituted a 7-day prescription limit on certain pain pills for certain conditions. Also in this bill, they strengthened the prescription drug monitoring database that was set up years ago to track prescriptions so that you could see if people were doctor shopping or if certain doctors or pharmacies were writing really large amounts of pain pill prescriptions, larger than what would be considered normal. And that database, though, had some holes in it. Doctors weren't actually required to register and check it, and now they're going to require that doctors do that. And so the idea is that you'll be able to track folks who shouldn't be getting some of these prescriptions more easily, and they're going to share that information with other states. So some of the money in this bill went towards enhancing that database. It's interesting, the governor actually opposed that database when it was first implemented for privacy and other concerns, and now he's been a champion of using it. So he's kind of evolved on that issue.
Right, because the data shows it really has made a huge difference. I think it was implemented in like 2009, and you can just look at the overdoses went way down in certain categories. So moving on to higher ed, Steve, you mentioned that in the budget, higher ed funding was a priority, and it expanded the Bright Future scholarships. The legislature also eliminated free speech zones. What does that mean?
My understanding of that legislation is that it allows the universities to continue to sort of sequester demonstrators in certain areas to control for crowd control and other things, which is a direct outgrowth of the Richard Spencer appearance at the University of Florida last year. On the higher ed funding front, again, you know, it's an interesting thing about the legislature and legislative leadership. If you sort of put all your eggs in one basket, which is what Joe Negron did, you have a higher chance of prevailing. Joe Negron had a lot of priorities, but his overriding priority was to enhance the quality of the state university system. Joe Negron has been fighting with the state colleges, or what we used to be known as community colleges, because he does not philosophically support this notion of having a four-year state college system. He thinks that the state university system should be the jewel of higher education.
Right.
They've got more money, and they're probably going to still see or will be seeking more. However, we did see during the session, and I don't have the number in front of me, but we saw during the legislative session a national ranking of universities that showed both UF and FSU rising, which gave the legislature further impetus to go in this direction.
That's good news. I'm glad to hear that. Let me ask you, who do you think were the biggest winners in this legislative session and the biggest losers, starting with you, Zach?
I think that you have to say that on the gun issue, you know, that the people in Parkland, the students, I mean, they got involved. And whether or not you like what the legislature passed as a comprehensive package, they did make change. You know, oftentimes with issues like this, there's a lot of debate. Maybe they pass sort of something incremental that isn't very controversial that everybody can agree on, and then they go home and the issue sort of fades away. And we've seen a much more concerted effort to keep the pressure on and force lawmakers to deal with this issue. And I think that the bill that they passed is actually, you know, has some fairly substantial measures in it. You know, and it's polarizing. It has issues that appeal to either side of the political spectrum on guns, but you certainly can't say that the legislature didn't act on this issue. And I think you have to give a lot of the credit to the students and the victims and the advocacy that they put forward.
And who lost out?
Who lost out this session? Wow. Well, I think that some of the issues that were overshadowed, like the hurricane, Irma, you know, they did do some things. They instituted a requirement that nursing homes and assisted living facilities have generators so that they'll be able to maintain a certain degree of air conditioning systems after the hurricane. We saw some people die in a nursing home that had sweltering conditions after they lost power. But some of those issues really did get overshadowed. There was other concerns that the hurricane brought up, such as evacuation and fuel supply shortages and things like that, that weren't maybe as dealt with in as great a detail as otherwise would have been. So I think who lost out were the folks who were kind of looking for more of a comprehensive look at some of these other issues.
Steve, do you want to answer that?
Yes. Well, I'll pick one winner and a couple of losers. I think Rick Scott was a winner in this legislative session. I think he showed leadership and moved very decisively in a way that I haven't seen him before. Of course, we haven't had a crisis like the Parkland shooting before. And so when he announced the legislation, if you recall, he held these series of stakeholder meetings that I covered several of them, sheriffs, mental health professionals. I think he brought people to the table for a serious conversation about gun violence, and this legislation resulted. Two losers. The National Rifle Association. The NRA is still a powerful force in this state, especially in Republican primaries, but they're no longer seen as this invincible force. And I think some candidates are going to discover to their horror that having an A rating from the National Rifle Association is no longer this vaunted thing. I mean, it might be helpful in a primary, but it's not going to be seen as a badge of approval with independent and moderate voters in a general election. It is a severe, it could be a serious albatross to be held in high regard by the gun lobby. Another loser, I think, this session were public schools. And I say that because the K-12 funding increase is largely illusory. It's not this big historic increase that they make it out to be. And we continue to see from this legislature a philosophy largely orchestrated by Richard Corcoran to favor charter schools and school choice over the traditional K-12 public system.
And I'm wondering, of all the laws that were passed this year, what do you think just the average family in Florida will feel the most? Any of them that will make a change to people's life? I'm thinking maybe the tax holidays.
I would say this was if you're a big believer in tax cuts, this was not a crowning achievement. In fact, considering all the money that they supposedly had to throw around, the tax cut package was pretty puny compared to past years.
Mm-hmm.
168 some odd million dollars. People love that back to school holiday issue. It's very popular with the general public. What this legislature did that affects real people, average people, I think loosening the interest rates on these payday loans is going to be an issue that many low-income folks are going to deal with.
Explain that a little.
I also think basically they made it so that you can take a little longer to repay the loan and the interest rate is a little bit higher. Surprisingly, a lot of people in low-income areas came out and supported that bill, and it passed overwhelmingly by both chambers.
Right.
In addition to that, I think a far-reaching issue, but the voters have the last word, and that is the proposed constitutional amendment that's going to require a supermajority vote by both houses of the legislature to raise taxes in the future is far-reaching. But again, it has to get support from 60% of voters. I think it probably will. Who wants to vote to impose higher taxes on themselves? But that's going to hamstring future legislatures in this state.
And one thing they did is they increased the Bright Futures scholarships for certain students and cemented into law some increases that they had passed last year. So that could help people, especially lower income folks, afford to go to college if they might not be able to. So I think that could be significant for a number of people. The opioid bill, trying to stop people from getting addicted in the first place could have an impact on folks. So I think that those are two things that could really help average people.
And I think they're going to feel it in another way, just an average person who goes to get a prescription because they've had a tooth pulled or something.
Yeah, Richard Corcoran, when they signed the bill, he was down here in Bradenton at the Manatee County Sheriff's Office with Governor Rick Scott. And the speaker said that this is going to be an inconvenience for some people, no doubt, but that the inconvenience is worth it to try and save lives down the road.
Zach Anderson is the political editor of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Steve Bosquet is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You'll hear more of this conversation on our podcast, Florida Matters More. You'll find a link to subscribe on our website, WUSFnews.org. Just click the Florida Matters link or search for Florida Matters More wherever you get your podcast. You can tweet us at Florida Matters. And there's a new way to reach us at WUSF.org. There's a green button that says Start Recording. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. The engineer is George Govan. The producer is Stephanie Colombini. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.